Welcome to Journey from Jacob. From our first breath to our last heartbeat, we are all on a journey. Jacob was a biblical character whose journey is documented for our benefit. Like all of us, there were unforgettable moments along the way, which required decisiveness. One of those decisions determined his destination. We will not only discuss Jacob's journey, but Israel's as well, right up to date. May this podcast inspire you to make choices along your way that will benefit others and guide you to the destination we all long for.
Shalom, Chavarim, the Mishpacha Sheli. My name is Paul again. This is Comfort My People's podcast called Journey from Jacob. I want to address something that a lot of people are concerned about. It's like, we have so many Bible studies. Why do we need another one? And I understand that too. But the Bible is so important that people are drawn to it, and a lot of people leave frustrated very quickly. And I think one of the keys is to study it sequentially. I think that's a major key because it's a sealed book from start to finish. It never should have interrupted with an Old and New Testament. There's different stories, I understand that, but to consider one old and one new, the new one's actually quite old too. It's 2,000 years old almost. So the names don't work, but mentally we're prepared for something that's really not that important when we're studying the Old Testament, which is so contrary to God's will because he's the author. So in this case, we are moving back from where Jacob was in his journey. He became Israel. He was named Israel from God, and which became a new identity, which we will explore more as time goes on. But it's real important to do sort of a Star Wars thing, which I don't think Star Wars invented it, but it's starting a story kind of at the end. We started it kind of in the middle, and we're moving back to the beginning because we have to see why Jacob was actually the man that he was before he became Israel. Because these are dysfunctional families, and there's reason for it. And one of the main reasons I think that we can identify with is that God was never looking for people that were superheroes. They were not movie stars. They were people. And in their day, they had a whole lot of baggage to carry, even though it seemed like such a simple life. So you got to think in terms of civilizations, which were very, very crude and wicked and vile practices that surrounded Israel, all around Israel. And so in order for us to be able to understand some of the issues that Jacob specifically went through, we need to follow how it started from the beginning. So we already started in the garden. We talked about the fall of man and how the serpent was cursed. The land was cursed, but Adam and Eve were not. But their lives seemed like they were cursed because of the way things turned. They were exiled from the garden, and they started to have family. And Cain was the firstborn, and Eve said, God has given me a man. Now, that's an exciting statement she made. We just read those words. But it was exciting because God said that from her would come the seed, which is the woman. She's the woman that talks about in Genesis chapter 3. And that seed will one day, God never said when and which one, but one day crush the head of the serpent. And so many Christian scholars or Bible teachers will jump from there all the way into Matthew chapter 1, where Jesus shows up as the seed of the woman. Well, that doesn't really work. So we missed so much on the way there because there's this anticipation that started in the minds of those, beginning with Adam and Eve, who are going to be key players in this story until their time is over. And then it goes to the next generation. And this is in Hebrew, the word for generation or seed is zera. And that word is first used in the garden, the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, both zera. One is a physical seed and the other is a spiritual seed. Satan had no children. The seed of Satan was those who complied with him, those that followed him, those that bought into his protocol and his agenda and followed him willingly. That's the seed of the serpent. We see it all throughout human history. But the seed of the woman is a literal physical genealogy line that starts with Cain. But Cain killed his brother Abel. So the two of them were the seed of the woman. She was anticipating one of them, at least, first it was Cain, to be the one that would crush the serpent's head because she didn't like the idea of the curse, nor did her husband Adam. By the way, we don't hear from Adam after that. And I think there's a real important reason to consider is that her firstborn son, kills her second son. Now, we're not going to go into that in detail, except to acknowledge that God tried to stop Cain from doing what he knew he was going to do. He said, sin crouches at the door and longs to get you, Cain. Don't do it. And yet, we know what Cain did. He did it. And then Cain is exiled. So here is Adam and Eve. They lose their firstborn son to his exile. And the secondborn son is dead. So the first human event, this activity outside of the garden, is a murder. It's a murder trial. And God is the judge. And so these two characters are no longer there. Unfortunately, Abel, maybe he could have been the one. So we don't know these stories. And here's why people kind of give up on the Bible. They think, oh, this is confusing right away. I don't get it. I don't know why God does this, why this happened, why couldn't he stop? And we start thinking like, oh, you know, God is not to be trusted. The book's not to be trusted. It's got so many flaws. And before you know it, the Bible goes on the wayside. But this is the key, that the Bible is a book of faith. And we see that in Eve because she trusted God at his word. Now, the Bible is also a book of promises. And promises are somewhat equal to prophecy because a true prophet will speak according to God's word and it'll always be true. It'll come to pass. Whether it's in his day or later in time, it will come to pass if it's one of those things that thus saith the Lord. That's an expression in King James. So if we don't believe that, then we don't have the faith to continue. And I'm not saying drop the Bible. I'm saying, God, I need to understand this. And I know it comes through faith. It's spiritually discerned. But these are human people. These are human beings. It's a history of humanity. At the same time, it's a history of God and his interaction with man. So don't throw things out that you don't understand. One of the most important verses in the Bible is from Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5, is, to lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him. Put your trust in him, but lean not on your own understanding. It's actually a command, very strong command, because our tendency is to say, I don't understand this, but what you're really doing is you're leaning on what you don't understand rather than believing what is being presented to you. Because we don't get the full picture. We don't get every jot and tittle of every story, and we don't get the whys and the wherefores, but we're called to trust. So it's a book of faith. It has to be read from that perspective. By faith, it says later on in Hebrews, many things happened, one after one of these characters within the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, did all these different things by faith in chapter 11 of Hebrews. But it's also the only thing that pleases God. So living by faith is a matter of trusting God for the seen, but more so the unseen. Jesus would repeat this over and over again. So we don't want to just give up on things we don't understand. I believe that if you take this Bible sequentially, you're going to find out that's true. And it's powerful and it's empowering for you and your spiritual life and your walk with mankind. You'll be able to do things you never would have done if it wasn't for faith. Now, faith, we'll go fast way forward. Our faith is not faith in faith. It's not faith in ourselves. It's faith in God, but it's the faith of the Son of God that we inherit in the new creation, which is critical. So from there, we're going to kind of skirt through the genealogy, but it's not Cain, it's not Abel, and then she has a son named Seth. She calls him Seth. Seth means appointed one. And literally what she's saying is perhaps he is the one. So she's still believing. This woman is incredible. With all the crushing emotional blows, just try to imagine. She only had two sons and both of them are gone. And Adam, I believe that's why he's silent. He just can't do it because he knows that this is on him. He did it. So these fruit that they weren't supposed to eat, he chose to be more important than the fruit they were allowed to eat. And he went ahead and listened to the one he should have ignored or rebuked. So that's the serpent. So we move forward in the genealogy and we're really skipping a lot. But we go from Cain and Abel are gone. Seth is the new son. His name is Appointed One. Very applicable. And so he moves on. We see Enoch walking with God. He's in the line of Seth. Seth's firstborn is Enosh. And it's the first time that men begin to call on the name of the Lord. And that's crazy because they were like 100 years into the garden by the time Seth was born, I believe. And it seems like, why didn't Adam talk about God in all this time? You'd think that men were calling on, but they weren't. And I think it's because Adam was just so blown away. Maybe he never recovered. I'm sure he's in heaven. I'm sure he got redeemed. He lived for another 700 years or so. So he had plenty of time to get it right with God. But in the meantime, there was not much going on spiritually. And so we move forward, we keep going, we come to Lamech, who's the father of Noah. Lamech calls his son Noah because that means comfort. So comfort is that, according to Lamech, Lamech was a man, and he was tilling the earth, and the earth was not too easy to get food from. You had to work with the sweat of your brow, and there were thorns and thistles and mosquitoes biting and such. And so he wanted his son to end this affliction that he was experiencing after the curse of the ground. And so he named him Comfort. Maybe he will relieve us of our toils. But it wasn't Noah. But we're still following the seed, so we pass through Noah, and he has three sons, and Shem is the third son, and we see that out of Shem came the knowledge of God continued. So his two brothers came to his tent to learn, and I'm speculating somewhat, of what's God doing? What's happening here? What's spiritually going on? Give us the rundown. And so the history of, you know, from the garden on is being passed down generation to generation, and they're very acutely aware of their beginnings. So we keep going from Shem. He has a grandson named Terah, who has a son named Abram, he names him. And Abraham is where we're going to focus on now. We're going to jump into the story in Genesis chapter 12. Now, I would recommend that if you have a Bible, you'd kind of open it up. If you'd like, you could always write down these verses and come back to them. He's the first one that's been called. Abraham is called to follow him. So it says here in verse 1 of chapter 12, "Go from your country, your kindred, your father's house to the land that I will show you." So there's a specific place he wants to show him. "And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you." And some versions say dishonor those who curse you. "And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." This is an incredible prophecy that God makes, and he's promising Abraham. So promise and prophecy are one and the same. So Abram went. Now, what does it mean? He doesn't know. God just said that I'm going to bless you. He doesn't know what he means. Now, bless literally means to kneel before. And God is really blessing him. He's actually, the picture is that he's kneeling before Abraham and saying, "Abraham, I'm going to bless you. There's a purpose for this, Abraham. I want you, yes, to be blessed. I want you to have a good life. Yes, I do. I want you to have descendants because you have none now. And you will, Abraham, you will. And I'm going to bless you. And I'm going to make you great, not great for the sake of being great, because of what you're going to do out of your greatness." So this is a blessing. It's for all the families of the earth. It's universal right from this point on. So Abraham went, as the Lord told him, and he departed. It's a wonderful story, and I just encourage you to read it from start to finish. But we're going to be moving through it to Abraham's moving into the promised land that God promised him. It's Canaan. And then he's finds that he's got a problem where he had moved towards. Now, is Abraham moving where he wanted? God didn't say exactly where to go. He just said, "I'm going to show you the land. You're going to take possession of it because it's going to be yours." So he moved from verse 8 to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent. Bethel means the house of God. So we don't know when it was called that, but somehow it's in the Bible at the time of Abraham's movement. And he stopped there and he built an altar to God. And he called on the name of the Lord. But then he continued to journey. Now, as he did, he moved south. Now, the question is, why would he move south? He's already in the southern portion of Israel. There's beautiful, fertile land. And he'd walked it, or cameled on it. But why is he going towards Egypt? And then, as he's going, he discovers that there's a famine in the land of Canaan. And it was severe. So, Abram went down to Egypt. Now, here's what's interesting. He goes down into Egypt and he tells his wife, don't tell him you're my wife. Otherwise, it's going to go wrong for me. They'll kill me. So how does he know all that? So this is, we don't know. But we do know that the information of what was going on in Egypt land was run by this Pharaoh guy who was, he was terror. He was mean and he was controlling. And the only reason that Abraham was going down there was because there's a famine and he heard that there was plenty in Egypt. So he went down there and it wasn't a good idea. It wasn't the right idea, I'm sure. But he went down there and God didn't stop him. So he goes down there and it goes wrong for the Pharaoh because Pharaoh sees Sarah, his wife, takes him into his harem, probably, and then he's cursed. Everything goes bad for the Pharaoh. Why is that? Because he didn't bless the one who he was called to bless. He didn't necessarily know that. I'm sure Abraham didn't get close enough to tell him that. But Abraham was trying to be a blessing there, no doubt. I have no doubt of that. That he was doing as God told him. He was joining God in the promise that he made for him. That's a critical thing. So anyway, things are going wrong with Pharaoh, and he realizes that it's because he took Abram's wife as his own. He was a sister, a distant sister, but, you know, it was kind of deceiving. So anyway, there's great plagues that happen in the king's quarters, Pharaoh, and he moves Abraham out of the land. But he moves him out of the land, and in the meantime, Abraham had become wealthy, very, very wealthy. In fact, as we go on, we see that in chapter 13, he was very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. So we see this blessing now, even though Abram probably made the wrong decision, probably God was going to do it in a different way, because God's not into this violence thing, and yet he had to scare Pharaoh out of his seat so that he would release Abram. Abram becomes a type of the people of Israel because they also came out of Egypt, out of slavery from a ruthless Pharaoh. But they also came out with silver and gold, which we're going to see much later. Anyway, so he moves, and now he's back at Bethel, but this time he puts his tent there, and he makes an altar, and he calls upon the name of the Lord. And he and Lot part company because they're both so rich, have so much livestock, that the land can't handle both of them. So Lot moves towards Sodom, which was not a good idea. But we're not following Lot's story. We're following Abram's story. And Abram, he offered Lot first choice. Wherever you go, I'll honor that choice. And Lot chose that because it looked good. It was good to the eyes. Remember that problem? So Abram settles in the land of Canaan, and Lot just near outside of Sodom. And that was a wicked place. It was known for its wickedness. It said, great sinners, the wicked, were against the Lord that lived there. So they separated, and then God has Abram by himself, and he tells him to lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, north, south, east, and west, for the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. So he's repeating the promise, but he's even making it more specific. Everything you can see is going to be yours and your offspring. It's so important to understand that this is not just Abraham. It's your offspring. So we have to follow the line of Abraham because offspring is Zerah. And we're not done with Zerah. This continues through the entire Old Testament into the New Testament. This concept of descendancy from Adam. And now we're singling out other children that were born, other sons that were born. And we're focusing on specific ones because it's through Abraham, it's going to be Isaac, but we haven't gotten there yet. So, and then he tells him this, I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth so that if one could count the dust, your offspring also could be counted, which is obviously impossible. So he doesn't have any kids yet, but Abraham's believing and he keeps moving. He keeps listening to God. Then we move on to a very interesting chapter, chapter 14. So this is a bit of time that took place between the time he was in Egypt to this point. And there's this war that took place. We won't go into the details, but it's four kings against five kings. One of those kings is the king of Sodom, and one is the king of Gomorrah. One is the king of the Goyim, which means nations. The word Gentiles comes out of the Hebrew word Goyim. And that doesn't mean they're bad. It just means they're not Jewish. They're Gentile nations. By the way, Abraham wasn't Jewish. His descendants become that way. That's another story. So anyway, this kings, four kings against five kings, and it's a bloody mess. And the five succeeded. And then something happened that got Abraham's attention, that he was told, he got this messenger came to his house and said that the enemy has taken all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah, and they also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother. It was his nephew. But he's basically raised him. So from Sodom, Lot was taken exile and his possessions and his family. So he's gone. And Abram's concerned. So when he heard this, it says in verse 14 that his kinsman has been taken. That's literally his nephew. He got his trained men who were born in his house 318 of them, and they went in pursuit of Lot, his family, and his possessions. Now, this is separate from these kings warring against each other. And so he brought them all back. So this is the thing. This was nothing, not around the corner. He went from the southern part of Israel, like in the Negev, all the way up to where the tribe of Dan is, which is way far north. And there they camped out, and they came up with a strategy. And then from there, they kept going north into Damascus. It's a long journey. And this was just to rescue his son, his stepson, or his nephew, I mean, who became his son, and his family and their possessions. Now, I mean, what are the odds? Well, when God's on your side, apparently, the odds are pretty much in your favor. And so he defeated them. He defeated these kings who were there with all their bounty, probably getting drunk and having orgies and whatnot. And he interrupted them. It doesn't say how many were killed or anything like that. He just defeated them. And then he brought back all the possessions and Lot, his kinsman, along with his possessions and the women and the people, which would be his wife and daughters, Lot's. So after his return, though, something interesting happens. He's coming back to where he lived, and he meets two very interesting characters. The first one is Melchizedek. Now, if you're a Bible reader, you know that Melchizedek is an important name in the Bible. It's mentioned in the New Testament as well as the Old, a few other places in the Old, mostly in the Psalms, but then in the New Testament as well, especially in the book of Hebrews. So he's a strange character because he has no beginnings and no ends. We don't know where he came from, where he's going, where he was born. He's not in the line of Abram, but he's called the priest of God Most High. Salem means peace, and Melchiz means king. So he's literally the king of righteousness, the king of peace. Melchizedek, king of righteousness, king of Salem, king of peace. And yet we know nothing else about him. And he sees Abraham and he says this, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram turned around and gave him a tenth of everything. Tenth. That's the first time we see this concept of tithe. So why did Abraham do this? There's no priesthood. There's no law of Moses telling you have to do this. But it was in him. He had knowledge of foreknowledge of what this meant. But it was he was giving him something. Now, many scholars, if not most, and I'm not a scholar, but I go along with what I believe is true, is that Melchizedek, at least all Bible teachers would say that he is a type of Jesus. But is he actually Jesus? Well, there are times when Jesus shows up before his incarnation in the book of Matthew and Luke. So what do we mean by that? Well, he was born. He's the seed of not the woman. He's the seed of God. So he has no sin in him. But he's the seed of the woman, which is very strange. So here he is, Jesus, the descendant, if you follow this genealogy, of Abraham. Abraham, in a sense, is giving to Melchizedek, who he's a priest that has no beginning and no end. And in Hebrews, it refers to him much more clearly, and as well as in the Psalms, that he's not just a man. He's not just a king. So if he's just a type of Jesus, well, then this is really not a person. You know, it's a king that's kind of strange, but why would he show up? And why would Abram give him 10% of all his possessions? Well, I believe he was actually Jesus. They call that a pre-incarnate theophany of Jesus, that God shows up. And we'll see this, that Jesus does show up throughout the Bible in the Old Testament before he's actually literally born from Mary. Don't get confused by that. It's really in the supernatural because, let's put it this way, Jesus is all God and all man. How does that work? So it's not all logical. That's what I'm trying to say. This is why it's a book of faith. But this is written so that we would believe. John said at the end of his book, and there's reason to believe because it's what we're intended for. We're designed for faith. So we continue the story and we are left with the king of Sodom shows up now. As soon as the Melchizedek, the king of righteousness, king of peace, takes the tenth that Abraham offered, and then Abraham is confronted by the king of Sodom. And he also wants to have a conversation with him. So before we do, I want to go over to the next chapter, chapter 15, which we were going to end pretty soon. But God is further giving Abraham the confidence he needs that what I'm telling you is true. But there's a lot of opposition, Abraham, that you have to understand. And this is what life's like. Now, so going back to, you know, that God blesses him, and the next scene, he has this little altar he builds. But then after that, he goes down to Egypt, which was the wrong move. And it seemed like it was going to go bad, specifically for Sarah, his wife. And Abraham, why did you do this? And he was there for a long enough time to become wealthy, but everyone left safely and actually in better shape. So God redeemed, I'm sure Abraham was sorry for what he did. So he repented by it. That's not written in, but it seems very obvious. And life got better. But then he's also, you know, he's on the awareness now that there's some spiritual things going on that he has to be very mindful of. And he learned that, I'm sure, a long lesson in Egypt, which was filled with idolatry. And so were all the Canaanites as well. But Abraham is singled out to believe, to live a different kind of life with the one and only true God. So chapter 14 opens up. After these things, which was what we just read, and we're going to go back to that. After these things, the word of God came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord, what will you give for me? I don't have an heir. I don't have any sons. This is what I want, a son. And so he tells him, you know, behold, you're going to have a son. The word of the Lord came to him and said, this man, Eliezer, who's your servant, he's not your son. You will have a son, and he will be your heir. And he brought him outside and he said, look to the heavens, number the stars, before it was the sand. Number the stars now, if you're able to number them, so shall your offspring be. And you know what Abraham did? It said he believed the Lord and he counted it to him as righteousness. So my question though, I kind of ran through this. It said, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be great. Well, we went from that scene where Abram took 318 men that were in his house, and he took them to save his nephew. He conquered these kings. He came back with his nephew and all his nephew's possessions and his wife and children. And then he meets Melchizedek. Melchizedek recognizes him. He blesses him. He brings out wine and bread. Isn't that interesting, too, that this is so typical of Jesus and the new covenant? So it can't be more clear that this is Jesus that he gave his tenth to. But then right after that, it says the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself. Now, what kind of statement is that? The king of Sodom was not on the winning side. He didn't fight this battle up there in the north to get back Lot and his possessions and his family. So what does he have to do with Abram here? And so obviously he was a man to be feared, the king of Sodom. He was the king of this wicked land where wickedness was prevalent and identified and horrifying. And I'm sure that it was very fearful to actually live in that city, as we'll see in Lot's life. But he says to him as a commandment. Now, Melchizedek did not tell Abraham to give him anything. He gave him what he had, the wine and the bread and fellowship. Abraham gave him a tenth of everything along with his fellowship. And they had this relationship developing. And then the king of Sodom shows up. Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself, as if he's doing him a favor. But probably in a sense, this guy was very fearsome. You know, bloodthirsty, having a knife in your teeth kind of thirsty. And Abram, though, courageously said this to the king of Sodom. He spoke truth to power. He said, I have lifted my hand to the Lord, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me. So he's just taking the bare bones basics for the men who were soldiers. They fought in battle and Lot's possessions and the family. There's no way I'm giving you the people. So this is what Sodom wanted. The king of Sodom wanted. He wanted the persons. This is what Satan always wants. He doesn't want our money. He wants you. And so why do I say Satan? Why do I say it says king of Sodom, Paul? How can you say Satan? Well, we're reading a book that has real people, real places, but that's also typical. They're symbolic of other concepts and other people, like the king Melchizedek, whether or not he was Jesus. No one said he was Jesus. He didn't say he was Jesus, I'd be Yeshua, but he is certainly a type of Yeshua, as well as, I believe, Yeshua himself. But if this is the height of what's going on here, picture this. Abram is having a meal with Jesus in this valley. And then comes the king of Sodom. He's a totally opposite of Melchizedek at the very least. Why couldn't he be a type of Satan? If not Satan himself, if Satan could show up on earth at different times when he tempted Jesus, why couldn't he show up at this time? In the beginning of this redemptive story, in the beginning of the most, some would say the most important verse in the Old Testament, which is, I'm going to make you a blessing to all the families of the earth. Why couldn't this be the king of Sodom who steps in to interrupt this process right before takeoff, and he wants the people? He wants the people. Why? And then he's going to give, literally, giving what's not his, is the goods. I'll let you have the goods, as if he owns them. But he was a threat to Abraham. And that is why I believe when we open up the next chapter, chapter 15, which we're going to see is an incredibly supernatural charged chapter, the chapter opens up and Abraham is afraid. He's afraid. And really, the question should be asked immediately if we're reading carefully. Why would God tell him not to fear? What's he afraid of? But God reminds him that I am your shield, Abraham, and I am your reward, and it is very great. And he has to calm him down because what he's about to tell him is so beyond real. He's going to give him descendants that are as many as the stars in the sky. Can you imagine what the sky looked like when there was no pollution in the air? And he's telling them to count the stars if you can. He can't count them because they appear to be infinite in number. They're countless. And God said, the Bible says, then he said to him, so shall your offspring be, just like that. And the weird thing, it's not weird if you have faith, but the weird thing, if you don't, is that he believed the Lord. He had no kids yet, remember? And God counted it to him as righteousness. What does that mean? That God saw that Abraham, he wasn't called Abraham yet, he gets it. He gets it. That I am his all in all. I am the great I am. All these things have not been discussed yet. God was not given all these names yet. But he's revealing himself to this one man, Abram. And Abram's believing him against all the odds. And so his fear was very real. But God came in and broke the fear. Don't be alarmed by fear. Because we live in a spiritually charged world. Not as charged as it was on the night that God confronted him after his episode with the king of Sodom, who very well might have been Satan himself. But this is how cunning he is. So we're seeing him act in the garden. We saw what he did. He forced the exile of the only two people in the world who were living under the greatest place ever. And then he was behind the murder of the second-born son from his brother because he came to him at night and said, don't do it. Don't do it, Cain. Sin crouches at the door. You know, sin is, it's embodiment of who Satan is. And that's what he's saying. He's crouching. You may not see him, but he's crouching at the door. So this is the story that we have inherited, and it takes faith to believe it so that we can continue on because this thing moves forward. All of this stuff that we've read so far, there has to be an end to it, and it has to be a good ending because as we're walking with God, as Enoch did in the garden, we're recognizing that he's good. He's good. He's not causing these problems. He's redeeming them as they show up, but he's allowing the consequences to unfold. So I hope that's going to help you to continue on. It's a remarkable story, but it takes faith to believe it for this journey that we are now taking from the garden into the future, along with Israel, whom we left off on his way back from Canaan. So shalom. And blessings, and lehitrot. Hope to see you soon.
We bless you for taking the time to consider this message. May it cause you to be fruitful and effective and lead others along the way with confidence and determination. Check out our website at comfortmypeople.com to become better informed and equipped to restore righteousness to the people of Israel, America, and beyond. Please consider sharing this and visit us on social media. Shalom and blessings.